From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wall Street stands tall at the center of American capitalism and national life. It's the ground of great fortunes and vast losses, of business titans and get-rich-quick scoundrels. Once a Calvinist America recoiled from the very idea of Wall Street, today President Bush is urging all Americans to own a piece of the street, to invest their retirement savings directly in the market. Tonight on Point, a cultural history of rascals and reward of Wall Street's place in the mind of America. But first tonight, we turn to Washington and Capitol Hill, where the House today passed a controversial immigration bill requiring states to verify whether driver's license applicants are U.S. citizens or legal immigrants before issuing the IDs. The bill faced strong opposition from governors, state legislators, and motor vehicle departments. Advocates said it is needed for national security. Joining me now to review the legislation is Gail Shattuck. She covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
So, who was pushing this legislation and why?
This is a fallback from the 9/11 legislation. You remember at the very end of the 108th Congress, Jim Sensenbrenner and House Republicans were pushing hard to expand on one piece of the 9/11 Commission report, which noted that the terrorists had an easy time getting IDs. And they took this observation and expanded it to something that not only sets federal standards for IDs, but also tightens asylum laws, and probably the most curious provision, gives the Secretary of Homeland Security the ability to waive all laws that impede construction of barriers to illegal immigration.
Such as the wall and fence up along the border with Mexico.
Exactly right. They're thinking particularly in this case about a three-mile gap in a fence between San Diego and Tijuana called Smuggler's Gulch. It's been pending environmental challenges for years, and that was the proximate cause for putting this feature in. But it was written so broadly that it really any part of the border.
So fences can go up anywhere, but the piece that's gotten the most attention is all around driver's licenses. What happens now, Gail, and how would that change if this is passed through the Senate and signed by the president?
Well, this is a very interesting piece of the law because, of course, some states have already passed laws allowing non-citizens to have licenses with somewhere between 9 and 13 million illegals in this country. It's not in the interest of states like California to have people driving without licenses mm-hmm. in uninsured vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the governor's concern. But it's interesting because the law doesn't forbid states to issue driver's licenses. What it does is say there's a federal standard for using licenses for federal ID purposes. So you could still, in principle, use a license. It's just you could never use it for any, you know, checking whether, you know, a check or for any federal ID purpose.
Or particularly for boarding a plane, which comes under federal oversight. Would that mean, then that if this comes into effect, that California driver's license holders would find their license ineffective or useless if they were trying to use it for ID in any federal circumstance?
That's what it sounds like to me. You could still drive your car, but you'd have a hard time without another form of federally valid identification, but like a Social Security card, to get on a plane.
That might lead to a whole new round of Social Security card lamination, I think, Gail. what does this mean? What's required, then, for a driver's license issued by a state to be acceptable under the standard set for the federal government in this legislation?
Well, I think the main thing is to have some sort of physical, like a digital photograph. That's what the 9/11 Commission pushed for. A lot of this is going to come out when the regulations are actually written about it. But the point was to have a document that had standards, for example, for what constituted a birth certificate and what would be a kind of permanent physical indication that the person holding the document is indeed the one who originally got it.
So they're getting into the state's kind of upstream process for determining in the first place that this is a U.S. citizen receiving the driver's license. They want that to be confirmed by the states when they issue licenses?
That's right. And, of course, the effect this is going to have down the line is states that have already decided to issue licenses that don't meet the federal standard may find themselves under a great deal of pressure to change that. This, of course, Native Americans with perfectly adequate birth certificates and a license, that, a driver's license that doesn't meet that standard, won't be able to use them either.
So the resistance is because it's such a bureaucratic nightmare to change the current systems?
No, I think the resistance, we have to think in a pre-9/11 way. Remember when we were all worried about a national ID card and the impact that would have on civil liberties? That's where some of this concern is coming from. We don't want to see the country, the culture and character of the country, so changed by the 9/11 experience that we don't recognize ourselves. So, for example, one piece of this law would tighten asylum laws. Does that mean that we send innocent people back to bad situations because they don't have, you know, pieces of paper that document they were persecuted? That could be one fallout from this piece. Do we want to have a Secretary of Homeland Security who is above all environmental laws in all states? Don't we like to think of ourselves as a country where people are not above the law? That is the concern that the critics are bringing up.
So broader power to deport political asylum seekers, to override environmental rules and putting walls up around the country, and to be much more sticklers in issuing driver's licenses. Gil Shattuck, thanks for the insight tonight.
You're welcome.
Gil Shattuck covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Washington. Wall Street has always been America's yellow brick road to dreams of great riches. It's often delivered. It's also been the seat of painful busts and epical skullduggery. The nation's attitude toward the street has blown wildly hot and cold, up and down over time. Right now, despite the deep losses of just a few years ago, it's riding pretty high. Half of American households own stock, compared to just 10% in 1960. And the president wants everybody into the pool. Tonight on Point, Wall Street's place in the mind of America. You can join the conversation. Do you see Wall Street as the rock of America's future or as a national casino? How is your view of Wall Street different from your parents' view, your grandparents'? And are you revved up for the ownership society? Are you already deep in it? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Steve Fraser. His new book is Every Man a Speculator, A History of Wall Street in American Life. Steve Fraser, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Steve Fraser, here it is, a big book with all the history going way back to the first days of the Republic. And through it all, you track a kind of up and down path of Americans' attitude toward Wall Street. We want to get into each of the big chapters of that history, but I wish you'd describe for us, if you would, just to begin, what's the arc through time look like? Where did Americans begin thinking about Wall Street and stock investment, and how has it traveled through time to where we are today?
Well, I think the great trajectory of that cultural story is an arc that runs from enormous fear and trepidation and sometimes real revulsion on the part of many millions of Americans about Wall Street and what it represented in our society, to a much more benign and even welcoming view about the role and benefits of having an institution like Wall Street in our midst. And really, I think that cultural center of gravity shifts only in our recent past, although there's always been a deep-running ambivalence right from the very beginning, from the days when Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson argued bitterly about the role of the government debt and speculation in the government debt. Right on through to the present, there's been an ambivalence, but the weight of opinion has gradually shifted from one of hostility and fear to one of to one that's much more welcoming.
You're really writing a cultural history. There's plenty of attention to the rogues and rascals and big winners on Wall Street, but your focus is cultural. It's on how the country thinks about it. You see it as a prism through which a lot of American life has been interpreted, and you make some
you tag some pretty big items on that list. Say the terrain on which we've wrestled with ancestral attitudes and beliefs about work and play, about democracy and capitalism, freedom and equality, God and mammon, even sexuality. How does Wall Street play into such a broad palette of huge subjects?
Well, let me pick one little piece of that. That is a very broad canvas, and it took 600 pages to write about it. But take our moral and religious life. For a long time, Americans felt very comfortable with wealth. They welcomed the opportunity to make wealth. They didn't have a problem with people amassing great wealth, so long as that wealth was the result of hard work, of productive labor, an application of the Calvinist way of life. America was a deeply Protestant, work ethic-informed society. Therefore, Wall Street became the place that was singled out that violated those canons, and it was seen as a place where people made wealth without working. And moreover, they were likened, the people on Wall Street, to gamblers. Gamblers were considered throughout the 19th century as irreligious, as anti-religious. They were practicing divination, that is to say, trying to predict the future, mm-hmm. something that only God could do. And they didn't work for their money in the minds of many millions of Americans. And so Wall Street became a kind of magnet that said, here's where the making of money transgresses moral boundaries.
The devil's playground then, but now a place where people work, and it's seen as real work, and a lot of people invest there. We've got to take a short break. Steve Fraser, author of the new book, Every Man a Speculator. Please stand by. Listeners, you can join us. What do you think? Americans have waxed and waned on Wall Street through history, but is it all happy days from here on out? And has the 401k democratization of Wall Street made it a safer, steadier place, or just left us hoping so? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Wall Street in the Mind of America. Our guest is Steve Fraser. He joins us from New York. He's author of the new book, Every Man a Speculator, A History of Wall Street in American Life. You can join the conversation as well. When everyone's an investor, is the country more likely to scrutinize Wall Street or to give it free rein? And does the scandal-checked history of Wall Street give you pause, or does it seem like history now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steve Fraser, I wish you'd give us the thumbnail history of the origins of Wall Street. How did it get started, stock investment in the U.S., and turn into the location and the giant institution we know today?
Well, I'll tell you a great story about its origins. At least I think it's a great story. The first Wall Street crash, or something that we would liken to a crash, there wasn't really a stock exchange in those days, happened in 1792. Mm. And it happened because a merchant prince in New York City, a man named William Dewar, who was a distant relative of Alexander Hamilton, and did work for the Treasury Department at a moment when the Treasury Department was first being established by the new Constitution, thought he had access to inside information about the prices at which these Treasury bonds would be set. Mm. And he and a group of merchant aristocrats like him tried to short the market, to speculate, to make a long story short, in the government debt. And they were way overextended. The market crashed, and as a result, the local New York City economy, for a moment, collapsed. And Dewar was literally chased through the streets by an enraged mob of people and nearly disemboweled. He was rescued just in time, carted off to prison, and died a few years later in 1797 in debtor's prison. It also involved, of course, Alexander Hamilton in a great intrigue, because someone who had worked for Dewar, a man named Reynolds, had actually used his wife to solicit Hamilton and inveigle him in an adulterous affair in order to get access to this inside information. And, of course, a few years later, the Jeffersonians, who hated the Hamiltonians, used this adulterous affair to embarrass Hamilton and depict him as a kind of moneyed aristocrat who was to blame not only for that little crash in 1792, but for for counter-revolutionary conspiracy.
No end of trouble out of that
little
affair.
So that's where Wall Street begins.
And how did it physically gravitate to Wall Street in Manhattan and become, when might we have recognized the origins of what's there today?
Well, the first stock exchange, it's called the New York Stock and Exchange Board, is established in 1817. And the reason it happens on Wall Street is that Wall Street had always been in colonial New York, a residential area, but an upper-class residential area. It's where the great merchants and businessmen of that era lived. And, of course, New York City itself was a very cosmopolitan and mercantile-oriented place. But the street was particularly the home ground for those people.
Now, in the 19th century, in the 1800s, who invested in Wall Street? Who was winning and losing and playing the Wall Street game then?
Well, you know, it's a very limited world, really. You have merchants and bankers, and the other set of institutions, oddly enough, you know, we think of Wall Street, we identify Wall Street with the free market. But in fact, in most of the 19th century, Wall Street made its living off the government because most of the securities, there were no publicly owned corporations to speak of in the 19th century. That doesn't happen until nearly 1900. What you have instead are canal companies, railroad companies, turnpike companies, all kinds of public works institutions, all of which are either semi-publicly or entirely publicly owned, that are floating bond issues in order to finance the construction of these facilities. Mm-hmm. And it's Wall Street and Wall Street brokers who deal in this government paper. And so actually the street is surviving off of this early form of mercantile economy that it characterizes the early years of American economic growth.
So nothing like the kind of popular, very widespread investment we have today. You describe the history of Wall Street as a record of deep ambivalence and cultural warfare. To take us into those woods.
Yeah, well, there are many realms in which that fight took place. For example, we are a country consecrated to the notion of democracy, but from about 1880 until 1920 or so, there's a great war in the country about whether or not democracy is going to survive, and it's perceived by many people in the populist movement, in the progressive movement, in the labor movement, and among small businessmen, that Wall Street represents the greatest threat to democracy because it's become so powerful thanks to its enormous wealth and control over growing sectors of American industry. Its power to suborn public officials, to buy senators, to buy congressmen, the record of political corruption, of what we today call crony capitalism, is so extensive, emanating out of Wall Street, that people see the street as a real enemy of the democratic way of life. And so that by 1912 and 1913, they're attacking particularly what they call the money trust, which they think is run by J.P. Morgan and is controlling all of American economic life and shutting down opportunity for everybody who's not in the charm circle.
If we could cycle back to that era and to Teddy Roosevelt, let's say, and his peers at that time, would he be thunderstruck to see the deep, wide involvement of Americans in the stock market today?
I think he would be thunderstruck especially at the extent of Wall Street scandals today conjoined to this notion that we all ought to get into the stock market. Roosevelt had no patience with and excoriated what the people he called the malefactors of great wealth. Mm. And these included the great Wall Street tycoons. There's a famous story about his confrontation with J.P. Morgan, for example, in those days, in which he let Morgan know who the president of the United States was, as opposed to who the head of a big investment bank was and who had the dominant position in the country. I think Roosevelt would be astonished, A, that these scandals continue to happen at a rate and in scope that exceeds anything he would have seen in his day, and that at the same time a president of the United States is advocating, and people are taking seriously the notion, that we all ought to invest in this same stock market, which is clearly being manipulated by very powerful financial and business interests.
Jack Beatty, join us here. We are at this fascinating moment when so many Americans are in the market. Many Americans have done well in the market for a long time, then took a tremendous hit just a couple of years ago, and still the faith is there, and the way forward is, in many people's expectation, one of more and more investment. Steve Fraser says, look back at history, and it's a much more sort of checkered attitude, but now we're headed into the ownership society.
Yes, but not without ambivalence. You know, from Theodore Dreiser's Copperwood novels to Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections, our writers have depicted Wall Street in a really single key as a center of false values, caught in the expression, "I've made a killing." And often, of course, it is a killing. I think of a headline from 1996, AT&T lays off 40,000, semicolon, Wall Street cheers. Now, there's nothing that can make that moral or right. And yet that's how our economy works, by the grinding down of people who work for a living by people who speculate.
Well, Jack, I have to just interject there. You say nothing can make that moral or right, but yet in many quarters, Wall Street is depicted as a great expediter, a distributor of capital, as in fact, the kind of transmission joint that has made the American history of economic miracle possible. That raises standards of living for many.
Yes, but at great social cost. Two things can be true. Something can work economically and hurt socially. And from the time of Dürer to Jay Gould to Samuel Insel, some of the greatest social bandits in this country have been speculators on Wall Street, and they have wrecked and done harm.
Stephen Fraser, how do you see it? You spent a long time deep in this history. No moral justification for what goes on there?
I think it's fascinating. I think that really, you know that people of late have, some people have done well in Wall Street, and that's undeniably true. But I think the cost that Mr. Beatty is talking about is very considerable, and we take for granted, for example, that during the 1980s, when Wall Street once again rode high, the age of Michael Milken before he went to jail, that this is an age of great economic progress, but really it's not. For average working people, their real take-home income declined all through the 80s until we were well into the boom of the 90s. Moreover, the 1980s is characterized by the gutting of American industry by Wall Street. Now, the people on Wall Street and others were making money off of that speculating and the lean and mean shutting down of American industry. But we are a country with a hollowed out industrial base as a consequence of that period of the 80s. What's fascinating is that the people who were doing it were thought of as rebels, not like the great tycoons of old. And this is fascinating to me culturally, but rather as rebels against a kind of ossified old order in American industry and banking.
The Schumpeter rebels there to remake it all.
That's right. They were remaking America. They were going to bring America back so it could compete with Japan and Germany. Remember, coming out of the 70s, America was in a very defeatist mood. And they were depicted this way. They were going to take on the kind of sclerotic bureaucracies in American industry and American banking and so on. And so there was a different image of these people culturally. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to me that that could happen when, in fact, they were doing much many of the things they were doing were precisely what the Insels and the Goulds and all the others had done for generations.
But we're sort of talking here about Wall Street as though it's optional. Isn't it, in fact, central to the American economic system? It wouldn't really work without it, would it? This makes the great financial market.
I think it's central to any capitalist economy. The question, and presumably that's what we have and are going to have, the real question I think facing us now and for some time is whether that's allowed to proceed unchecked by public supervision or by such a weakened public supervision that you get disaster. You get disasters like the scandals. These are not scandals where, some men made off with a lot of money. They did. But they also looted their companies. They looted their shareholders. They looted their employees and of course, left many of them out of work.
And you're talking about the 90s.
I'm talking about the 90s now. So these are social disasters. The question is, do you have a sort of government apparatus which is vigilant enough and empowered enough to stop that kind of thing from happening? Because we've lived through 25 years of, the ideology of deregulation in the free market. And it's left us far less armored to guard against the kinds of things which Wall Street has proven over and over and over again it's capable of doing. But now we don't. We abolished the Glass-Steagall Act, one of the Great Depression, New Deal era measures.
Under Democrat Bill Clinton.
That's exactly right. It's not about Republicans and Democrats, because the Democrats in the 90s were indeed very favorably disposed towards Wall Street. So the real issue is not do we need the market, but how is it allowed to function in our society? How freely is it allowed to do what it wants to do? And what's amazing to me is that people can continue. You know, after Sarbanes-Oxley was passed, and right
this is the
day,
legislation to hold corporations' feet to the fire, demand much more accountability and oversight.
Exactly. And already the business community and the Wall Street community is complaining that this is too much regulation. They are doing this in the teeth of an ongoing cascade of failures and bankruptcies that doesn't seem to ever end. I mean, you read the paper every day, it's continuing.
Steve Fraser, hold on. We want to get into the whole issue of checked and unchecked, but a lot of callers want to join us. I want to turn to them. Dave is calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Good evening. Great show. Thanks, guys.
Sure.
So I have a comment first, and my money's on black in Vegas. At least I know the odds and how much I can spend. Well, I'd like to know how far I'm off base here. And really, I see the stock market as having two functions, and one is to destroy wealth, and the other is to simply redistribute wealth. If there isn't money to pay for stock, then I can't sell it. And the money's a system, and it's kind of stuck there. So
But what about the creation of wealth? When Google comes along, changes the way the world works, it goes public, a lot of money is raised, and this is a whole new thing. Isn't that creation, Dave?
Well, I see it as money moving around. There's no new money in the system, if you will. The money goes to people that are fairly early in Google, and I would never buy Google. But but if someone can't pay for it, then the stock can't exist or certainly can't go up. So nothing is really created in my mind, just moved.
Dave, we've got it. Steve Fraser, here we are. Wall Street's been with us for a long time. The country's wealth has grown for a long time. Dave sees the street as just moving money around or sometimes destroying, but doesn't it also have a role in creating wealth?
Yeah, I think it does both things. I think it moves. I think Dave is right that it moves money around. And if you actually measure the percentage of, say, daily trades that actually end up in forms of wealth creation, it would be a tiny percentage of the actual volume of daily trades, which are buying and selling of paper that is for no other purpose but for the hoped for gain. However, it does do what you say as well. It mobilizes capital resources and makes them available and concentrates them in one place, say in a particular company that shows great promise. And this, of course, was Hamilton's notion in wanting the government to fund the debt of the revolution and so on. He wanted to draw together in a central place the liquid capital of the country so that it could then, he thought, be funneled into actual productive enterprise.
Into innovation, new productivity,
innovation,
new industries.
Exactly. And to some degree that worked, but to some degree it ended up in William Dewar. And so that's the problem.
Maybe that's the price. Tom's calling from South Beloit, Illinois. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good evening. What I was calling to ask your guest to comment on was the long-term versus the short-term capital gains. I don't think that we have our long-term capital gains set up long enough, because otherwise you get into what he's talking about, which is the gambling aspect of the stock market.
In other words, people getting in and out and looking to make a quick buck.
That kind of stuff, whereas they're trying to tell all of us, you know, common people, that we should invest our money in the stock market, and the companies just, you know, work on the quarters.
And so they're going short. You've got professional investors who are moving in and out all the time, but regular folk in for the long haul for their retirement. Tom, thanks for your call. Steve Fraser, how about it? That brings us to the ownership society, to President Bush's view of investors putting their retirement money into Wall Street directly. How does that sit in the historical chain here?
Well, there are two questions there. One, I want to just say that I think the gentleman is right, and that we all are forced to live in the short term. And what you have going on in Wall Street in this endless series of scandals is companies that are so preoccupied with their share value from moment to moment, from quarter to quarter, with satisfying the needs or the demands of Wall Street analysts and Wall Street underwriters of their stock, that every other constituency that the corporation is supposedly serving, whether it's its employees or its customers or its suppliers or the communities in which it is located, takes a distant back seat because we're all forced to live in that short-term window that's created by the street. And what you get is book cooking on an enormous scale. And, you know, Bernie Ebers, the testimony just today about WorldCom talks about this, where Ebers is essentially saying, we got to make our numbers. If that means we'll do a few illegal things along the way, we'll do that. Everybody's going to meet their numbers. I think what's so astonishing about Social Security, about this privatization notion, to me anyway, is that the greatest Wall Street moment of ignominy in the country's history was, of course, the Great Depression. And the Great Depression, next to the Civil War, is the great national trauma of our whole country's life. This Social Security emerges as one of the cardinal central defenses against that ever happening again. And it's extraordinary today that this most central piece of protection against the kind of economy that produced the trauma of the Great Depression is being scuttled, or talked about being scuttled.
Steve Fraser, stand by. Jack Beatty. The new book is Every Man a Speculator, A History of Wall Street in American Life. You can join us 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Wall Street in the mind of America. My guest is Steve Fraser, author of the new book, Every Man a Speculator, A History of Wall Street in American Life. You can join the conversation. Are you with George Bush? Do you want to make every citizen an investor? Could the economic miracle we've seen in America ever have happened without Wall Street? Is it the place for everyone? We're 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Patrick's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I wanted to sort of add a younger perspective. I'm 20 years old, and my father and I have spoken a lot about, you know, the stock market, because in the public school system, you know, they sort of teach you, you know, it's a good thing. Invest in the stock market. You can produce a lot of wealth for yourself. Yet I think it comes across to a lot of youth as a sort of a massive, confusing engine, if you will, for investing. And I think that one of the things that my dad has told me is that, you know, things like land to invest in are also just as effective and very important. And when the president's talking about this ownership, I think that's a good thing. I just think that telling everyone in America to invest in the stock market might not be for everyone.
So it's not the only way to ownership. Patrick, we've got it. There's a lesson from the father, Steve Fraser. But these days, when people talk about ownership and equity, It does seem at a mass level, Wall Street we're talking about.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I think one thing we need to realize when we think about ownership, the notion of ownership, is how overblown that notion can be. You know, we do have approximately 50% of American families invested in one way or another in the stock market, but the great overwhelming majority of them are passive investors. They're not exercising the kind of power over the property they presumably own that we normally or used to think or associate with ownership. And the young man makes an excellent point. They are not only passive, often they're deeply ignorant about what's going on in the market. Why wouldn't they be? Most of us are. I am. You know, there are a cadre of professionals who spend their lives learning about the variety of securities on the market and becoming relatively expert. And even those people make disastrous mistakes all the time. When you talk about the rest of us, totally unprepared to kind of make these judgments, and now we learn not probably too wise in trusting investment analysts and others to make those judgments for us, because there are so many incentives for those people to, in their own way, give biased, partial information. It's a frightening prospect. The other thing is that ownership used to carry with it the notion of kind of personal identity, of control over property, of a kind of way of life, whether it was invested in the land or in a business and so on. The kind of ownership we're talking about here is a very abstract, distant, and without any of the powers of control except to buy and sell what you own, but over the actual underlying material entity that you presumably own. You have no control over that whatsoever, and so you don't own it in a certain sense.
Jack Beatty, I wonder, we're hearing a lot of caution, woe, the stories of scandal from history and very, very recent history tonight, still in the courtrooms today, as Steve Fraser points out, and yet Americans in extraordinarily large numbers are voting with their feet, with their checkbooks, with their hard-earned cash to get into this market. They seem a lot more sanguine than what I'm hearing tonight.
I wonder about that. I mean, is the 401k revolution something that Americans are enthusiastic about, or is this something that America's corporations devised as a way of lightening their pension obligations? I think the jury is out on that. Yes, for people with some income to invest, it's a great thing. And, you know, if I had it, I'd do it, I'm sure. But for most people, is this 401k revolution really going to benefit us? Suppose you retired in 2000. You retired in one way, and someone who retires two years later retires at a 40% less. The market drops 40%. And, you know, this market, it is not run by geniuses. I mean, Galbraith, in his book on the Great Crash, has a wonderful sentence. He says, "Speculation buys up the available intelligence."
Right, and puts it to work.
People get awfully dumb when it comes down to speculation. They just make bad bets all the time.
If that's what it is. Patrick's calling from New York City. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have to say that I listen to NPR quite a bit, or public radio, and I have to say that this individual, I'm sorry that I didn't get the name or the name of the book, but it sparked my interest and I had a call.
I'll give it to you right now. Steve Fraser, Every Man a Speculator is the book.
Outstanding. I'll make sure I go to the bookstore and pick it up. But I just would like to highlight, the statement you made about Social Security being revamped. And I also would like to include that there have been, as I'm sure you know, that there have been quite a few Great Depressions, quote-unquote Great Depressions, 1837, 1857, the 1880s. But again, the Social Security system, the way I understand it, was set up so that it would help the workforce. But at that time, correct me if I'm wrong, the workforce did have a large union backing. And I think the unions really started to gain some power under the FDR administration and thereafter World War II. And I think now the unions, I should know, I work in the transit system, and our union really doesn't have the type of stability that it had years ago. But moreover, I think that it is important to realize that there has to be a checks and balances system. I mean, capitalism, of course, is the most advantageous system. And, of course, our society, the way I understand it, is not really 100% capitalism. I don't want to.
But it's also volatile, and it can be vulnerable. Patrick, let us pick that up. Steve Fraser, take us back to the Great Depression. Patrick reminds us there have been more than one depression, but with the Great One. And the attitude shift, when you look at the cultural history here, from the 1920s to the 1930s, on the other side of the crash and what ensued, how would you describe in broad terms what happened there to the American public view?
I'd love to do that. I think Patrick's point is a great one. I call this era that begins with the Great Crash in 1929, Wall Street's age of ignominy, because in the 20s, just like in the 90s, the late 90s that we've just lived through, the great figures of Wall Street were seen as wise men, as infallible. They had invented an economy that had somehow solved all the problems that had periodically disrupted lives for generations, as Patrick notes. In fact, there's a panic or depression more or less every 15 or 20 years in the 19th century. And then the crash. And that that milieu of Wall Street bankers, speculators, but not merely the speculators like Jesse Livermore and so on, but the great bankers of that time, Charles Mitchell, who ran the largest bank in America, the National City Bank and so on, all of them were implicated in this incredible crash, which then turned into this horrific, nearly decade-long depression. Wall Street came out of that not only hated, but also came out of it seeming to be a place of fools and incompetence, of kind of omni-incompetence. And as a result, Wall Street vanishes almost from public cultural life for nearly 30 or 40 years
after
that.
A
long, long time. And one of the reasons, and this is what I think is so brilliant about Patrick's comment, one of the reasons they are able to make the kind of comeback that they do make, there are many reasons, but one has to do with the decline of the labor movement, because the labor movement and the New Deal in the 30s represented an alternative way of organizing the economy and protecting public welfare. the labor movement, for a variety of reasons, especially in the 1970s and 80s, went into steep decline, a decline it's still in. And as a result, it ceased being a point of social leverage that could be used politically and in the economy to stop Wall Street and corporate America from exercising more or less total dominion on these issues about how the economy was going to be run. And I think that's part of what has happened to the culture, is the loss of a kind of alternative voice, which always used to exist. Wall Street always had to contend against that, whether it was the labor movement or the progressive movement or the populist movement.
But now all the gravity right there on Wall Street. I want to get one more call here. It's a great point. Jim is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Jim, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, sir, you're on.
I'm from Wisconsin, but I would tend to differ a little bit. One, the Great Depression had nothing to do with Wall Street. That was government policies and trade issues. But let's not dwell on that.
Okay. That little crash was there.
Yeah. Pardon me?
Yes, sir. Go on, please.
The other thing is that I started a company in the 70s, and when they first started 401ks, I got in it with all my employees. And for 25 years, I forced them into it. I educated them.
And how did it work out for them, Jim? Our time is short.
Because they didn't know how to do it. It worked out just fine. Because if you look at it, there's no alternative. Everybody can moan about unions, and they can moan about this and that. But our capital markets are deep. Our capital markets are what make our whole economy work. And either you buy equity or you buy debt. And equity pays more than debt.
We've got it. Our time is short. Let me pick it up right there. Steve Fraser, this is the way our capital markets work. This is where our economy is organized. This is the way it's going to be. A lot of Americans look at it just that way.
Yes, I think they do. I think there is a kind of air of inevitability. I think in this gentleman's opinion, it's a good thing. I think other people might say it's not that good, but it's kind of the way things are. To some degree, that's undeniable. You know, one of the interesting comparisons between our own Gilded Age that we're maybe still are living through and the one in the 19th century is the kind of attitude we take. Jack Beatty mentioned Theodore Dreiser. And if you look at Dreiser or Edith Wharton or William Dean Howells, and their attitude towards their Gilded Age, it's one of criticism and condemnation and a kind of suggestion of something that might move beyond that. If you look at Bonfire of the Vanities, a brilliant piece of social satire by Tom Wolfe, there is an air of fatalism about that book. This is the way things are. Everybody's corrupt, and it's going to be that way.
Jack Beatty, if President Bush has his way, it looks like this will become more the way things are.
Yes, it does. And if he has his way, I think Galbraith's statement, speculation buys up the available intelligence, will once more be manifested.
Well, we shall see. Steve Fraser, Ownership Society, we're at 50% or roughly that now. Where do you think we're headed? Could we have an America where everybody is directly invested in the stock market?
That's a very difficult question to answer. I don't think so. I think everything, to some degree, depends on what's ahead for this economy. And nobody knows what that is. Is it endless growth and prosperity, or is it a new depression? We're none of us seers enough to know the answer to that.
Well, Robert Schilling, Yale economist, has talked about irrational exuberance before the last crash. He said, well, there's a threat to turn the United States into a nation of gamblers. And as anyone who has visited a casino knows, most gamblers lose. Well, we hope not in this one. Steve Fraser, great book. Great talking with you tonight. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Steve Fraser, author of Every Man a Speculator, A History of Wall Street in American Life. Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
In a moment, one family's story of medical bills and bankruptcy. This is On Point. A new study out last week found that nearly half of all Americans who file for a bankruptcy do so because of medical expenses. That's 2 million Americans in 700,000 households forced into bankruptcy by health care costs each year. And it might surprise you to know who those 2 million Americans are. Most are from the middle class. Three-quarters had health insurance. Half of the households included had at least one college graduate. For even the well-off, a serious illness can lead to a downward spiral of high co-payments and deductibles, to the loss of a job, loss of insurance, and bankruptcy. That was the predicament that faced Deborah Heinrichs of Kingwood, Texas. In June of 2000, her husband, Christopher, was diagnosed with terminal melanoma. 3 years later, her family filed for bankruptcy. In this radio diary, Deborah Heinrichs recalls her descent from a middle-class life to bankruptcy.
We were a normal middle-class family in the Houston suburbs, both husband and wife working, bringing home an income of about $100,000 to $125,000 a year. And we're just living a normal, happy life until June of 2000. Our insurance at the time was an awesome plan. We, you know, had never used it other than for maybe, you know, colds, flu-type symptoms, and that was it. So I really never had a need, you know, great need to use my medical insurance up until this point in time, and never could have been told what type of medical expenses my family was fixing to incur. You have co-pays to clinic visits and on prescriptions. Your insurance also has a cap on it once you reach a certain out-of-pocket that they will pay on a yearly basis or sometimes on a lifetime basis. One of the prescriptions that my husband was on for quite a while through his treatments was Zofran. It is for nausea in your stomach. And the insurance will only allow you to get 15 pills at a time. And those 15 pills, my copay was $80 each time I got 15 pills. And when you're taking chemo on a, you know, three-time-a-week basis, and you have to take one before you get there, they give you a dose when you're there, and you take another one before you leave to keep from vomiting, you can imagine how long and how far 15 pills are going to go. We had come down to one income, which was mine, and I make in the neighborhood of $13 to $14 an hour. And when you go from someone who brings home about, you know, 45 to 50 on their own, and then you go down to just a $14 an hour job, and you have a house and car and children, and you need to eat, you've got to pay COBRA, you've got to pay for prescriptions, you have to make some decisions here. When you have a bankruptcy on your record, number one, you can't get loans. Number two, you pay higher interest rates for everything. And the worst thing I've come across is now that I am a widowed lady and supporting two children is I have now been laid off from my job in the midst of all of this and am finding it quite difficult to get a job because one of the first things that they want you to do is sign a paper that says, oh, yeah, we can run a credit check on you. And, of course, then I've got to sit there and explain why they see a bankruptcy on my credit check because, you know, here I am handling their money, and how could I handle someone's money when I'm filing bankruptcy and can't pay my bills? I guess the one lesson that I have to say for everybody is try to start thinking, you know, what if this happens? Because at some point, you may very well lose a second income. And if while you have the opportunity to put money behind, try to do that because you never know what's going to be facing you next.
Deborah Heinrichs lives in Kingwood, Texas, with her two sons, Joshua and Travis, age 17 and 14. Her husband, Christopher, died last April. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio. Support for On Point.